On to lecture 8, consumerism. Consumerism. What is consumerism? How should we think about it? So consumerism can be thought of as the belief that personal well-being, happiness, and status depend largely on the level of personal consumption, particularly in the acquisition of material goods. Strictly speaking, one might think that consumerism isn't just about material goods, but I think material goods are the primary way that the notion of consumerism is anchored. Hyperconsumerism is the frenetic pursuit of consumer goods. A consumerist society is one in which one of the main recreational activities is shopping, in which products are discarded quickly because they're out of fashion. They can be replaced with something newer and often better, but before the useful life of the previous product has taken place. An indicator of being in a consumerist society is that if you have, for example, a particular kind of smartphone and the newest one comes out and your previous one you were thrilled and delighted with and it serves actually all of the functions and purposes which you really need, but you become increasingly kind of irritable with it and dissatisfied and people are showing you their new iPhone or whatever it is that you have, and you become increasingly dissatisfied with what was previously a source of gratification, not because of any failure of itself, but because there are better ones on the market. And other people are displaying their better ones. They're making a big deal of it, partially as a symbolic expression of how cool they are and how good they are at consuming relative to you. It's very hard not to feel that dissatisfaction creep in. And it's even very hard if you're a sophisticated professor who's strongly anti-consumerist. I mean, you know, lay my soul bare here. I'm a gadget lover, and I find it just an interesting phenomenon that things that I really liked become less satisfactory, not because of any intrinsic failure in the things that I have, but because I see all the cooler forms that colleagues and often students have for these things. I try, you know, because of kind of my own ideological commitments to having a non-consumerist lifestyle, I try to resist such sense of dissatisfaction. But it's clear that it's not entirely voluntary. You know, it's not something that one can simply turn off in a world where there's so much stuff being thrown at you, which is given such publicity and given so much status. It's also often a common experience, I'm sure all of you have had this, that when you finally then go ahead and buy the new thing, it actually doesn't turn out to be that much different and that much better than what you had before. Sometimes it lives up to the hype, but as the word hype suggests, more often than not, when things are purchased because of intensive advertising and the effort to play off status anxiety around those ads, it often doesn't live up to the hype. The new ads on television for the Galaxy smartphone, the Samsung smartphone in competition with the iPhone, which has all of these smug Galaxy owners meeting people who are in line to buy an iPhone and showing all the things that they can do that the new iPhone can't actually do yet, that being the kind of symbolic embodiment of that anxiety around shopping in a society that's so oriented towards having one's fulfillment and happiness in life centered around the things one consumes. One really, I think, poignant indicator of consumerism in the United States and how it works and the, you know, the character of it as an economic process is reflected in the growth of median house sizes, of new home construction in the United States. This is a graph that comes from a dissertation of one of my graduate students who's now just got tenure at Ohio State. Rachel Dwyer did her dissertation on the sociology of housing, and particularly around the issue of this problem, why have houses grown so much in size in the United States? As you can see in this graph, until about 1983, the size of houses, of new home construction, varied roughly between 1,400 square feet and 1,600 square feet. If you go back further, back to 1950, between 1950 and 63, average house sizes of new houses gradually went up from about 1,200 to 1,400 square feet, sort of fluctuating around that low level. Suddenly, in the early 1980s, the size of new home construction went up quite dramatically. If you look at here's another graph that really shows this. If you look at the growth of really large houses, that is the percentage of new homes that are over 2,500 square feet, and of small houses, the percentage of new homes that are under 1,200 square feet. In the 70s, there were more houses built under 1,200 square feet than over 2,500 square feet. By 2005, less than 5% of houses were these small bungalow-type houses, and over 40% were over 2,500 square feet. Those are really big houses. I mean, many of you may have lived in houses that big or bigger, but these are really large houses. One of the things about really large houses is that they can contain a lot of stuff. One explanation for the growth of the size of houses has been this is meant to be a bit of a joke, I suppose, but there's some truth in it. It's been the growth of the size of television screens. I mean, you cannot have a 52-inch television screen as easily in a bungalow house, because you need a really big den, which would take up half the house in a really little house, if you're going to have a gigantic television screen. And the reverse is true. Once you buy a really big house, you can buy more furniture. You can buy bigger televisions. You can buy all sorts of things. So big houses are one way of anchoring higher levels of consumption, and of course a response to higher levels of consumption. As we'll argue in the next block of the course, big houses are also a reflection of the fantastic increase of inequality in the United States. Because big houses, of course, are bought by more affluent people who have more discretionary income, that is, more income beyond what they really need to satisfy their basic comfortable consumption needs. And the increase in inequality has driven up the average size of houses. Now, one might say, what's the big deal here? You know, if people want big houses, they should be able to buy big houses. There's no problem. It sounds, you know, like a snotty intellectual who has peculiar values thumbing their noses at people who just want big televisions because they're cool, they're nice. What's so bad about it? The general view of things in a consumerist society is that consumption is good. It's a bit like happiness. You can't have too much of it, right? Nobody would say there's anything wrong with increasing happiness. The happier you are, the better. What's wrong with increasing consumption? It often sounds arrogant to say to someone, you are consuming too much. You spend too much time shopping. Sounds like, you know, as I said, a kind of arrogant, elitist thing to say. I know what's good for you. You should not shop so much. You should not consume so much. This view that it's arrogant to criticize consumerism is especially the case in the free market paradigm, where markets faithfully register people's autonomous preferences for consumption relative to other values. So consumerism, therefore, seems like an expression of freedom. Freedom in the sense that we talked about earlier in the course. If the market fully recognizes and reflects the autonomous values and preferences that people have, it is the consumerism then is a reflection of their choices, and to criticize their choices is, in a sense, to impugn their freedom to choose. Why would anyone ever want to say that people over-consume, and why is this a problem? Before I give you my answers to that question, what do you think? And of course, one option is it isn't a problem, that I'm, you know, just spouting sort of left-wing ideological prejudices, and that my critique of consumerism is simply, as I said, an arrogant put-down of most people's authentic preferences. So what do you think? What pros and cons, what reasons for or against consumerism can you come up with? Yeah. Okay, so one point is that there, from the point of view of the environment, environmental sustainability, what theoretical category would this be an example of, given the ideas we've talked about? This would be a case of negative externality. Good. So that's a negative externality of consumerism would be non-sustainability. What other problems might there be with consumerism? Is that the only thing you can think of? All right, I'm going to give you a different assignment. Turn to the person next to you. And for 2 minutes, I want you to discuss, to brainstorm together. Just do little gaggles of people. Not, you know, turn to the people behind you, next to you. Get little discussion groups of 3 or 4 people. I'll time it for 2 minutes. Think about other reasons why consumerism might not be such a great thing. Go. Start talking. All right. Okay, what else? There's a lot of buzzing going along. There must have been at least a few ideas that were aired. Somebody, raise your hand. Yeah, back there.
People who are afraid of debt.
Other ideas. Discontent, I think one could say that it doesn't actually produce the happiness that they wanted. That would be another discontent, happiness deficits. How about that? Yeah.
Greed.
Consumerism connects to greed. It fosters greed. It encourages a culture that is more self-interested in that way. Yeah.
Depletion of resources.
That would be part of this. Depletion of resources, let's put that here as a specific aspect. it's another face of the environmental issue. Yeah. Okay, so inequality of wealth distribution, is that a... I think inequality of wealth distribution is a problem. We'll discuss that in the next section. I'm not sure it's a consequence of consumerism. It may contribute to consumerism, but I'm not sure. It's one of the reasons we say there's a problem with consumerism because it leads to inequality of wealth distribution. Other ideas that are quite different. Yeah. So there's opportunity costs. Of what to do with money. Opportunity cost, the idea of opportunity cost, that's an economist's term. I haven't used it, but it's a good term. It's another term that one should at least have some familiarity in your ears. What opportunity cost means is that if you spend your time or your money or any resource on one thing, there's certain other things that you can't do. And the question here would be, is if a consumerist use of resources, of money, blocks other things you might do. And that's complicated, of course, because some of the other things you might do might also be consumer-oriented. One way that you might think of this problem is what a consumerist society does is focus all of our attention on private consumption rather than collective consumption. So it encourages us to look for cars as the things we want to spend our collective money on rather than public transportation. So consumerism underwrites this devaluation of public forms of consumption in favor of private forms of consumption. And in that sense, consumerism would indeed create opportunity costs. We can't do certain things with our collective resources publicly because our culture is so oriented towards private consumption. Other ideas? Just want to see if somebody who hasn't spoken yet. Anybody? Anybody in the far back who hasn't spoken? Yeah. Okay, so consumerism is very closely connected to advertising. So it's both that advertising causes consumerism, but a consumerist culture invites lots of advertising. Our willingness to tolerate commercials on television, for example, is bound up with us living in a consumerist culture, which sees that as a perfectly reasonable way for our consumption of television, which is one of our leisure activities, to take place. Okay, one last.
Inflation.
Well, there may be a little bit of connection in some loose way between consumerism and inflation. Inflation is really caused by a whole variety of other underlying economic processes, which may or may not be connected to this particular issue of having a culture and an economy that's so connected to consumption. All right, now I'll give you my answers to the question. What is wrong with consumerism? There are three sorts of things. These are different problems, although connected. There are big negative externalities from consumerism. The environmental externalities are a crucial one that we've already mentioned. Consumerism, in fact, doesn't make most people very happy. It's not that consumption isn't part of happiness. Certainly, having deprivations, being poor, makes people unhappy. The research on happiness and income indicates that there are very big improvements in basic life satisfaction and happiness as you move from being poor to being comfortably well off. But there are pretty sharply diminishing returns, happiness returns to increasing income as you get higher and higher income. That it takes, if you have a high income, you don't get much more happiness by having even a higher income. So consumerism is based on a view of human happiness that's pretty thin. Most people, as I say in the book in passing, most people at their end of their lives on their deathbed don't say, damn, I wish I bought more gadgets in life, rather than spend more time with my loved ones. The things that make people have a rich and meaningful life are mostly the fabric of social connections one has, and social support, and friendships, and love, and meaningful activities in which one engages. Those are the source of individual fulfillment, along with the things we consume. But a consumerist society just shifts our weight on things that actually don't produce as much happiness. And finally, there's a whole series of processes that can be called systematic biases in the system that generates consumerism. So here, these are what's wrong with consumerism. The what's wrong part is what's wrong with the underlying processes that generate consumerism. And if these system biases were eliminated, many people, and perhaps even most people, would opt for a less consumerist lifestyle. There are systematic underlying biases in the way the economy is organized that pushes people towards consumerism. And if those biases were eliminated, people would choose a less consumerist lifestyle. So this last point is pretty important because it says, in response to the critique, remember I said the critique of an anti-consumerist is that it's arrogant to tell people you're consuming too much. This is the key response to that argument. It says the reason people consume so much is not actually because of free, autonomous choices on the part of people in which they're weighing the pros and cons of different choices and saying, gee, I think the best thing to do is to consume a lot. Rather, this argument about systematic biases in the system says people exist under constrained choice, which leads them to make, with higher chance, these highly consumerist choices. Now, we've looked at one example of that already with the public transportation story. Right? So once you tear up the trolley tracks and you get rid of efficient public transportation, then individuals are going to choose a more consumerist lifestyle, that is buying private cars, and then investing in an automobilized way of relating to mobility in a way that they don't, people don't when they live in big cities with good public transportation systems. So that's just one very specific example about how a system biases people towards private consumption rather than public goods by the nature of the choice environment in which people make their choices. What I'd like to do in the remaining time is go through these system biases. And there are a total of six system biases that I want to explore with you. The topic for our lecture on next Tuesday is healthcare, which is a big topic. That takes a full intensive session. So if I don't get through all this material, it'll be on the web, on the slides, and in the chapter. But I'm not going to, on Tuesday, begin with the end of this lecture. We'll just do as much of this as we can. Oh, by the way, I should have said at the beginning of the class, I'm sure you're all aware that 2 weeks from today is the first midterm. I'm available for in office hours today and next Thursday, and anyone who wants to talk about any of this with me, you should come to my office hours. Or if you can't come to those office hours because you have classes, then come to me after class and we'll set up a separate time. But mostly you should consult with your TAs about the midterm. You know, they'll be able to answer whatever questions you have about it. One thing I'd like to say for all of you, I strongly oppose exams which put time constraints on anyone, not just students who have official permission to have untimed exams. I think this should be true for anybody. And so what we will do is have the exam in this room, except for students who have asked for accommodation in a smaller room. We'll have the exam in this room. I'll try my best to design the exam to be easily completable in the time available. But if we run out of time, anybody who just is doing it in a slow and careful way and they need more time, after the time in this room is over because another class comes in, anybody left will move them over to the social science building for however much time it still takes. So all of you can rest assured there's no time constraint on the exam. And I'll also try to make it, you know, roughly a half hour exam, and we have an hour and 15 minutes is my goal. Okay, first system bias is in capitalist profit maximizing strategies. Capitalist firms make their profits from selling stuff. The more people that buy, the better off they are. They compete with each other. Capitalist firms compete. That's one of the virtues of capitalism. And this competition leads each capitalist firm to try to sell more stuff. Suppose that a voluntary simplicity anti-consumerist movement gained strength, and that the mass of American people said, enough is enough. I want a simpler lifestyle where I consume less, have more leisure, more time with my family, where I'm going to invest my life course in the web of social relations and in activity rather than in consumption. What would happen in the American economy if 70% of Americans decided to opt out of a highly consumerist lifestyle and move towards voluntary simplicity? That's the term that's used by the social movement that advocates simplifying your life to have it be richer in non-material ways. Well, one of the things that would happen is that lots of firms would go bankrupt quickly. We would go into an economic recession, probably depression, perhaps collapse. There would be an onslaught of programs to try to increase people's consumption, to get them out of the voluntary simplicity movement. Voluntary simplicity would get ridiculed as being stupid and in other ways destructive of the American way of life. The economic collapse would hurt everyone. It wouldn't just, you know, hurt the workaholics, it would hurt everyone, including the people who were opting for voluntary simplicity. Voluntary simplicity still needs employment, you still need income. And if you are in an economy in which the vitality of the economy depends upon selling ever more stuff, and you try to reduce the amount of ever more stuff that people consume, it'll be hard to consume any stuff because you won't have income. Think about the current recession that we're in. What's the remedy that's called for? People should spend more and save less. So think of the problem of it this way. From the point of view of profits, if you double productivity, so when productivity means how much stuff can you produce for a given amount of inputs, right? So if you double productivity, you have two possibilities. You could produce twice as much stuff with the same inputs, or the same amount of stuff with half the inputs. Those are the two things that can happen if you increase if you double productivity. You could double leisure time and keep consumption levels constant, or you could double consumption times. From the point of view of capitalist firms, which is better? To double the amount of things people consume and keep them working just as hard, or to reduce the work week by half if you doubled productivity? Well, from the point of capitalist firms, increasing the market, the sale of the stuff that's produced, is the more profitable option. So that's the first point about the bias in a profit-making, profit-maximizing capitalist system is towards increasing consumption as the basic dynamics that makes the system work well. And this is why capitalist firms devote so much money to advertising. This is a chart that shows the annual amount of time or exposure to advertising for various different sorts for children, teens, and adults. The average adult is exposed to 50,000 ads a year, approximately 2 weeks of time. So roughly 4% of your life, 2 weeks out of 52. So 4% of your time is spent being bombarded by advertisements of one sort or another. There's more discussion of this, of the advertising face of consumerism in the book as well. Capitalism needs growth rooted in the continual expansion of markets, and a consumerist society is a key component of that growth dynamic. The second system bias can be called market failures in leisure. Let me just present some quick statistics. These are all in the book, so I won't belabor them. This is the number of hours more per year on average that Americans work than people in other countries. Look at the comparison with Germany. Germany is a prosperous, highly productive capitalist economy with much lower unemployment than the United States, and generally has had lower unemployment in the United States. And the lower unemployment in Germany today is in many ways quite remarkable, because remember, it was only 20 years ago that Germany absorbed Eastern Germany, which was part of the former Soviet bloc. That was an enormous disruption to the German economy, because Eastern Germany was operating under a completely different economic system. They had to absorb that entire labor force into an integrated system. And that was extraordinarily disruptive and difficult to kind of reintegrate and create a new stable equilibrium in Germany. And yet the average German works 9 weeks less a year than the average American in terms of hours because of increased vacation time and shorter work weeks and way less overtime. I mean, overtime, American work weeks are long because of overtime work in many occupations. And yet the German economy does this without going into a tailspin. If you ask people the question, how much of a future pay raise would you give up for additional leisure? Would you rather have more leisure in the future? So you have your current standard of living, your current wages. If you had a choice between working 25% less or earning 25% more, which would you choose? When people are looking forward in time, they would give up, this is the percentage of people that would give up pay raises for proportional declines in work, that is, proportional increases in leisure. And you can see that over 40% of workers would be willing to give up all of future pay raises if the equivalent in the pay raise could be turned into reduced work. People would prefer more leisure time to more pay, but that's not an option that's on the table in the American labor market. And just one final thing, this is the kind of chart of weeks of paid vacation in the United States and other countries. A member of the class sent me an email asking about the relationship between this chart, which shows that Italy has the highest number of weeks of paid vacation, and another chart in the book, which shows the average work week. And the question was, how could Italians work as many hours as they do when they have the number of this very high number of weeks of paid vacation. I can't, without going back to the original data sources, answer that question specifically. But just let me make a note. So this is a kind of social science-y data note about these kinds of charts. The source of data for the weeks of paid vacation comes from one kind of source, which looks at the legal rules in different countries for paid vacation. And so in different countries, there are different numbers of mandated by law paid vacation, number of weeks. That's one factor. And there's different numbers of weeks that by contract employers have. That's one source of data. And another source of data asks people about how many hours they work a week and then calculates annual hours worked. And sometimes there's discrepancies between these different sources of data. They're gathered in different ways. They come from different government agencies. And so it's entirely possible that that particular discrepancy simply reflects a discrepancy in the way the data was gathered. But it could also be that in some places people work relatively high number of hours per week, but fewer weeks per year. So the total number of hours per year wouldn't directly reflect the number of weeks of paid vacation. Okay, so all of this data simply shows that in the United States we work much harder than other countries. We do work longer hours, we have fewer paid vacation, and fewer other ways in which work time is reduced. And all of this reflects market failures in leisure. The argument for what the mechanism is, why we have this market failure in leisure, that's discussed in the book. Let me just briefly give you the basic explanation. Why do we have so much less leisure time? Why do we work more hours per year? Employers often prefer longer hours rather than hiring more workers at fewer hours, because there are fixed fringe benefit costs and training costs associated with employment. And in particular, for large employers that provide health care benefits for workers, we don't have a public health care system. Health care is provided as a cost to employers, particularly to large employers. They would rather have people working overtime than hire more people, because if you hire more people, you have to give more health benefits. It's cheaper to have somebody work 45 hours a week, to have many people work 45 hours a week, than to have people working 35 hours a week and hire that many proportionally more employees because of the fixed costs per employee of fringe benefits. Weak unions and weak labor market regulations prevent the collective regulation of work. The long paid vacations in Europe are the result, typically, of strong labor movements that either through political processes passed laws in favor of paid vacations or in their negotiations with employers. And there's more about this in the book. Third, system bias, the changing reference group for consumption norms. This is a pretty cool topic and a real kind of hardcore sociological topic. So if some of you find this particularly interesting, maybe sociology is worth looking at studying further. This involves understanding this idea of a reference group. This reference group are the people around you in terms of which you evaluate how well you're doing. This has very wide application. You've all heard, I think, the expression peer pressure. Peer pressure. What does peer pressure for adolescents mean? The idea of there being peer pressure in high school means you have a group of people that are your reference group. They're the people whose opinions you care about, who define your self-esteem and how well you're doing in life or in your social standing or whatever. And peer pressure means pressures that you're experiencing by virtue of the reference group that you're a part of. A bright student who is part of a reference group in which academic achievement is regarded as uncool is much less likely to do well in school than a student with exactly the same intellectual capacities and even intellectual desires, but are part of a peer group in which it's seen as great to do well in school. All right, so a reference group is a really important idea. It's a kind of core part of micro-sociology to understand how people come to have the aspirations and lifestyles that they have. Now, a consumption reference group refers to the category of people with whom one compares oneself and asks the question, am I doing well or not? Most people don't compare themselves to Bill Gates and say, damn, because I don't have a 60,000 square foot house, I must not be doing very well in life. All right, so most people's consumption reference group are people who are in many respects more or less like themselves. There's one kind of reference group, however, that doesn't exactly correspond to the people who you have direct interpersonal face-to-face contact with. And that's the reference group of people who you see on television. So just consider the following. This comes from Juliet Shore's work. Juliet Shore is a wonderful sociologist in Boston who works on the sociology of consumption. She's probably certainly one of the leading sociologists of consumption in the US. She has looked at sitcoms on television and asked the following interesting question. Where in the income distribution is the average sitcom located? In the 1950s, the average sitcom was located in the lower middle class or around the middle, often working class. The average sitcom now is somewhere around the 70th or 80th percentile. They're up at the top, not the extreme top, some are. You know, there are some up in the top 1%, but mostly sitcoms are located among affluent, quite affluent urban income earners, somewhere around the 70th or 80th percentile. Now, if you watch sitcoms and you think that's the typical household, then your reference group can shift up and you can feel, ah, that's what I should be able to consume. And therefore, people are willing to take on more debt in order to consume like the models, meaning not fashion models, but the role models that they identify with on television. And here, of course, is where a key issue around consumption and consumerism comes up, the creation of a really easy way for people to accumulate debt, to take the attitude, why put off consuming more until I can afford it, when they can do so just by simply putting a piece of plastic. In the book, there's a extended discussion of credit cards. This is just one little piece of data about the change in the average credit card debt between 1990 and the early 2000s. Credit card debt peaked just before the economic crash. It has gone down some in the last few years because of the severity of the economic crash and people trying to actually reduce their debt load for the first time in a very long time. Another source of system bias that underwrites consumerism is inequality itself. Now, this is a complicated kind of issue. How does inequality create a bias towards consumerism? The key thing to understand here is what's sometimes called positional goods. Here's just a simple, straightforward example. Since one's access to good schools for one's children depends upon the neighborhood, and since the increase in very high incomes in the top 20% of the population generates more inequality in neighborhoods, a person may have to escalate their consumption, move to a too expensive neighborhood, given their earnings. That is, buy into a more expensive neighborhood than they really can afford, in order to satisfy the real need of providing good education for their children. So inequality of housing is reflected in inequality of education. It creates incentives for people to try to move up to the more expensive neighborhoods in order to provide the best education for their children. To do so, they have to increase their level of consumption above what their income would really justify, and therefore take on more debt. Or another example that's sometimes used of this sort, if some people buy SUVs, not because they're off-road enthusiasts, but because they like big tank-like SUVs, then smaller cars become less safe. Small cars become more dangerous because of the density of big cars, heavy cars on the roads. One of the incentives for buying an SUV, therefore, becomes safety for one's children and oneself. Safety is not a consumerist value. Safety is a perfectly good human value to have for one's family. But one is forced, because of increasing inequality, which makes it easier for people to buy SUVs, for people who, for whom that would not be their consumption choice because it's more expensive, nevertheless feel pressure to move in that direction. Finally, just so we can get through the last system bias, the abandonment of public consumption by the affluent erodes the quality of public goods. Private schools become more attractive because of the deterioration of public goods. Wealthy people send their children to private schools. They then oppose taxes to improve the quality of public schools. Therefore, parents who can afford to send their kids to private schools but would prefer public schools may opt for private schools because of the well-being of their children, not because they have an aversion to public schools as such. Gated communities become more attractive because of the deterioration of policing and public safety. The ability to buy your own police makes you able to escape the consequences of deteriorating public safety. Again, increasing inequality, therefore, can drive the move towards gated communities, which reflects a higher level of consumerism in the economy. And we could go on with this. Okay, next week we do healthcare and finance.